This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
And welcome to another mind-blowing episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film guest. So good, it just has to be fattening. So good, it might literally make your head explode. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend and co-host. Hold on, I'm going to transmit to you all of his stats. Ready? I'm sorry if your noses are bleeding, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. I already knew that
because I can read your mind.
We are balls deep in March Madness, my friend.
That we are.
We are third movie of 1980s psychic films.
Yes. And if you'd like to be balls deep in this podcast, you can always follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And I don't know what the extrapolation of balls deep is, like what the next step in that is. But if you would...
Should we have a conversation with your fiance?
I don't know. Hilt deep? Hilt, like pelvic bone deep? This is getting worse as I continue. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Probably the worst commercial for becoming a patron since the last time we did a commercial for being a patron. But if...
Probably.
If against all odds you still would like to support this show, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We will kick you bonus content that only our patrons get to hear. And we've got some really exciting stuff coming up.
We've got some very exciting stuff that you get access to if you log in today.
Yeah.
You know, you get to, we've done a lot of a la modes this year, more than we planned.
We did an a la mode just last week with Joe Lynch on Logan, which I was referring to as Jogan, since we had Joe Lynch talking about Logan with us, and that was a lot of fun. And we did, as Cargill mentioned, an additional a la mode prior to that on... Wow, my mind is blanking. Did you steal that from my head just now?
Split.
Ah, again. Wait, no, I thought there was a one between Split and Logan.
There probably was.
John Wick 2. We did one on John Wick 2.
And we may do another one next week because there's just been so many great junk food movies this year. Like we are having a great, amazing year full of junk food. And you look at the summer and it's like, oh my God, there's so much great junk food this summer.
Yeah.
Like, and plenty of bad stuff too. Like, you know, there's some real things you'll wince at when you see on the schedule, but oh my God, it's been such a good year. That's why we've been doing this. Normally we do one a la mode a month and it's like every 2 weeks we've got something else we just kind of want to talk about because we don't know if we'll be doing the podcast in 20 years to look back and talk about them again.
We have not seen an embarrassment of riches like this since Mountain Dew introduced three new flavors. Guys, it is the perfect time to be a genre fan.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's a deep
Remember
cut.
That? Remember
yeah.
that? Delicious. Delicious Code Red and Baja Fresh. As if regular Mountain Dew wasn't enough to clog all of your arteries, here are different colors.
I just want Jolt back.
Well, you know, Jolt has all the sugar and twice the caffeine.
It does.
Which they actually said as if it were a good thing.
Yes.
A selling point.
That was the selling point. That's It'll why kill 11-year-old me would drink Jolt, vibrate through the walls, and watch shit like fucking Scanners.
Scanners is, of course, what we're talking about today as we continue through March Madness with all of its psychic killers. Qu'est-ce que c'est? This one, of course, is probably the crown jewel of psychic killer movies, right? I mean,
I don't know if it's the crown jewel. I would say that it is. It is. It's not the granddaddy of them, but it is, I think, like the daddy of them, where, you know, Carrie. Everything goes back to Carrie when you're talking about psychic horror. Like Stephen King really popularized psychic horror by giving us a really great conflicted villain with Carrie. And then from that, we started getting a bunch of these. Mm-hmm. And they started branching out. And this was the first one that really connected, because it's this young, hot director named Cronenberg who's coming out of the gate with some visual effects unlike anything people have ever seen before. This movie opens with a scene that just tears the roof off the fucking place. And frankly, doesn't quite live back up to itself until the end of the movie. Like it almost is like a case where they blow their load at the beginning and then can never live up to it.
It's almost quite literally a case where they blow their load at the beginning.
Yes. But then you have this great ending with all these great effects. And when you talk to like the older horror nerds, like Scott Weinberg and Drew McWeeny, who are just a bit older than me, but old enough to, they at the time Scanners came out, to be able to go out and buy the Fangoria with Scanners on the cover and see all the work in it. I was still too young at this point. My first encounter with Scanners was opening up the HBO, the monthly HBO guide, and there's the picture of the guy slammed up against the wall on fire. And I'm just like, 7-year-old me is like, what the fuck is this?
And how do I see it now?
Yeah. And it was literally one of those movies that I was so excited by that single photo and the little blurb in the book that I stayed up past, when my parents went to bed, I stayed awake. I snuck downstairs when I knew it was on and watched Scanners as like a 7-year-old. And it freaked me the fuck out.
I would like to scan all of you in this room, one at a time.
There are 4 billion people on Earth. 237 are scanners. They'll control your mind, conquer your will, manipulate your body like a toy.
Self-destruct, 5 seconds.
The pain begins. And your flesh. And your brain.
4 seconds.
You feel its power.
3 seconds.
The pressure. The pounding, the terror.
2 seconds.
You can't breathe. It chokes you. It destroys you.
1 second.
You begin to self-destruct. Experience the terrifying power of Scanners.
It is a crazy movie. And a very flawed movie. It is not Cronenberg's movie.
And that's interesting, because that's one of the things I was a little nervous about discussing on this episode, is as I rewatched it for the show, I realized, as much as I still love Scanners, it is not exactly the movie I remember it being. And I was conflicted because I sat there thinking about all of these weird little things that didn't quite add up and these weird little things that didn't quite work. And this is a movie where, and I want to speak to the point you made about blowing its load at the beginning. They were so nervous about that the shot that we're talking about, this is a movie that most of you probably know, and this is the generation that we're talking to that probably first knew this movie or still know this movie as a GIF.
Yeah. As that was popularized back, at this point, we're talking like almost 20 years ago, when the Late Show was taken over by Craig Kilborn, where he had his top 5 questions. Mm-hmm. And he had 2 different GIFs that he would use, one from Story of Ricky and then this one of the head exploding that he would show on a loop. And of course, it would later become a meme and a GIF of the perfect head exploding loop, because dear God, that effect to this day is still fucking great
in slow motion. That is how much pride that Dick Smith, the amazing, the immortal Dick Smith, who did all the effects for movies like, The fucking Exorcist, is so proud of that effect, and as well he should be, that they have the balls to film it in slow motion.
Yeah.
And it holds up to this day. But what I was getting at,
big sloppy wet head explosion where a big piece of face falls forward with chunks of brain on it.
Oh my God.
It's just
so
like
good.
To this day, it's just like, oh, it's so gloriously awful in the best way.
That was originally the shot that scene that opened this movie. They were nervous that they liked that effect so much, they were worried that people who came in late to the movie were going to miss it and miss one of the major appeal of the movie. So they moved it back about 15 minutes. If you watch the movie, it doesn't really happen for about 15 minutes. And instead, we're introduced to our hero character first, Cameron Vale, played by Stephen Lack. I want to start a little mini segment on the show for as long as she'll allow me to, which means as long as she doesn't listen to the show, called The Unfiltered Fiancé. Because sometimes I watch these movies with my fiance, and the things that she says always make me laugh. And this one she didn't even watch with me, but I posted that GIF, that exact GIF that we're talking about. And I told her I had to watch this movie, and she said, "Is that the movie that you posted the GIF from?" And I said, "Yes." And she goes, "I don't know if I want to watch that," which I found surprising. I was like, "Well, you love The Fly. You're a Cronenberg fan." She's like, "Yeah, but that GIF was real juicy." And I was like, "Yeah, that's an accurate way to describe exactly what that effect is."
But the thing is that it does set you up for a movie that you're not going to get, because instead,
yes,
what you get,
yes,
is mental exposition the movie.
Yeah.
Like this is the thing that's interesting to watch about this, because I feel like here's one of the main reasons I wanted to talk about this movie is I do love this movie.
Oh, of course.
I do think this movie is seminal in this particular subgenre. But it's very interesting to see Cronenberg direct a movie that is almost pure exposition.
Mm-hmm.
People like squint and they stare into the camera and then they explain to someone else what they just pulled out of someone's mind or out of a computer.
Yeah.
And that's how most of the movie functions. So Cronenberg would then go on over the next few years and would smooth that out and get his storytelling perfect to the point where when he made The Fly, which we covered last year, he made a perfect play. And there's a lot of subtle stuff going on, a lot of subtlety to the storytelling. And then after that, he started getting more and more obtuse and more inaccessible in terms of his storytelling, to where he was cutting out exposition entirely. And so if you look at the later Cronenberg films juxtaposed against Scanner from a pure storytelling perspective, you can see the progression of him chipping away at exposition until he gets to the point to where he knows how to tell a story without telling you what the fuck's going on, that the audience can put it together. And I'm fascinated by that transition as a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, because you go from this on to his next film, which, Jesus Christ, that's that has lots of exposition as well, but is also so weird. So when you go from, like, Scanners to Videodrome to The Fly to, you know, like Eastern Promises.
Yeah.
Like, you are seeing a very different director that's evolving in a very particular direction. It's not like, you know, some directors where I do a little this, I do a little that, and you see these ebbs and flows in their career. He very much just starts chipping away and learning how to tell a story better and better until by the, you know, towards the end of his career, he has just, he makes movies like Spider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's like, what the fuck is going on? You'll get it eventually. Trust me. Just sit and watch. So that I find that notion fascinating, but it's also fascinating to watch how this defines the language for two things for early 80s audiences. It's explaining psychic powers in a way that, you know, becomes usable, accessible for people. And it's also explaining computers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is this weird scene that just does not play in 2017, where this guy is trying to explain why he can't get into a computer. And he's like, "Try again." So he types access the right program, like, and he types in the same thing, and he's like, there's no way in. Like, he doesn't try anything else. But then he sits there and explains how, we're connected to a telephone, so anyone with a computer and a telephone line and the right access codes could possibly be in the computer right now. Like, it's stuff that we, you know, in this day and age, you would just see stuff happening on a computer screen and the audience would be like, "Oh shit, there's a hacker," and understands all of that. But in 1980, you know, 1981, 1982, people didn't understand computers. And so they needed to be explained it in very slow, deliberate terms.
Yeah.
And so that scene plays very weird. And yet at the same time, I get it. Like, because the language that Cronenberg's creating is then used and built upon in all of these other movies that we would see. We would not have Dreamscape if we didn't have scanners.
For sure. And I think we're going to pop the tray down and rewind a bit back to that scene, that gif that you've seen on the internet. That is not the movie that this is. The movie that is set up by that gif is not the movie that ultimately Scanners is. And I felt revisiting it almost like I had a false memory implanted somehow, where I was watching a completely different movie than I remember. So what I'm going to ask of you, gentle listener, Junkions, friends, is to try and remove that image, that scene from your mind entirely, because there is an interesting mess that is this movie that I think is really important and really fascinating for a couple of different reasons. We've talked before about blue-collar horror films, horror films that are about regular working-class people. I think probably the best example is something like My Bloody Valentine, where you're literally talking about a slasher film in a mining community, and you know, have these really kind of salt-of-the-earth characters. This is a white-collar horror film. This is more. This movie is less like the other films of the. If you look at the other films of the era that were also pushing the envelope with effects, things like American Werewolf in London, things like The Thing, all of these movies that were really trying to build upon the work of practical effects artists and push the envelope for what audiences could expect to see graphically on a screen. This movie is less like those and more like something like The Insider. Michael Mann's The Insider, because what this is a deep dive political corporate thriller that happens to, as a story conceit, utilize people who can make other people's heads explode with their minds. And that is really not the way this movie gets described. That's not the when you're hearing one person recommend Scanners to another film fan, they don't use words like political thriller or, you know, corporate espionage or things like that. They only talk about the heads exploding. And that factors in only slightly. Like, it is the thing that moves us from one major event to the other, but it's really the byproduct of what's really going on in this story, which, as you know, and I was feeling conflicted about it as I watched. I was like, am I crazy? Or is Scanners lacking something? Is it not quite the movie I remember? So I actually went and tracked down Roger Ebert's review of the movie from 1981, and he was pointing out things that I was like, yes, that's what that was it. And one of the things he pointed out was that a lot of the reveal of what's actually going on happens just minutes before the end of the movie.
Yes.
So much of this movie is trying to unravel a mystery that you don't even know is necessary in a movie about heads exploding, because that's the movie that gets set up by that scene is a movie that is far simpler and far less requiring of dense, twisty plots than this movie actually has. And then I went further and I started looking at some of the history behind the making of this movie. And Cronenberg himself has called this his most frustrating movie, because apparently when he was making it, their production time got truncated to the point that he literally had to write and shoot at the same time. So he's writing the script as he's shooting the movie, which is why I think there are moments of this film where you're like, this is so, like you were saying, so much exposition and it's so dense here. And, you know, what are we really doing? And in the meantime, there is an interesting story about corporations basically fucking up the world and creating mutants and then trying to cover it up.
Which is very much a Cronenberg element.
Like, absolutely. This is, that's like the most Cronenberg thing about this movie.
Especially in the early 80s, most of his movies are about the dangers of corporations, the dangers of science going too far. You know, we're talking about, like, three of his movies are about unregulated science. Mm-hmm. You know, I pulled a boner a few minutes ago. I said his next movie was Videodrome, because I always think of Videodrome as his next movie, forgetting that The Dead Zone actually released before Videodrome.
Yes, both in 1983, Videodrome.
And I was going to mention The Dead Zone later, because he goes right from Scanners into making another psychic movie, and a psychic movie written by Stephen King, no less.
Yeah.
So, like, there is this, like, between Cronenberg and King, these are the guys that created the language, that created this subgenre that we're talking about this month.
And I feel like it also needs to be mentioned, this weird sort of incestuous window where you have Brian De Palma, David Cronenberg, and Stephen King.
Oh, yeah, The Fury.
The Fury in 1978, Carrie in 1976, both De Palma films, one based on Stephen King. Then you get to Scanners with Cronenberg, and then you have... It's almost like Cronenberg completing this weird visceral circle by doing The Dead Zone, where he gets to make a movie about a psychic based upon a Stephen King film. And you look at like those four movies and all the similarities and the differences. And one of the things I was getting at with movies like The Thing, movies like American Werewolf in London, and all these other big effects-driven movies of the era, Scanners is the one without any sense of humor whatsoever.
Yeah.
There is not one moment of levity in this entire film. It is so heavy. And the themes that it delves into, things like... you know, the irresponsibility of big corporations and how their malfeasance can lead to the mutation and the literal changing of the genetic code of people and what that can do and the dangers that can create and how they can go to lengths to cover it up. That's what the movie's about more than heads exploding.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you watch something like The Fury, and which I did just to kind of get a sense, because when we mentioned that we're doing Scanners, a lot of people brought up Fury. Oh, you should do The Fury. You should do The Fury. So I kind of watched these movies back to back. And one thing I noticed immediately is The Fury has big comedy beats.
Yes.
Like there's a moment where Kirk Douglas like literally jumps out of his apartment in his underwear and has to hold up his neighbors to get new clothes. And the old woman who lives there literally ends up siding with him more than her own family. Like, big, bold comedy beats in a movie that, by the way, opens with a terrorist attack on a cafe that is like really harrowing, but at the same time can switch gears tonally. There is no change in tone throughout the entirety of Scanners. Scanners is this one thing that you don't really understand until the very end.
You know what it feels like in terms of in terms of tone? Like it's got its own feel, its own flavor, but the movie I feel like would go back to back with it like almost perfectly is Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's got that same kind of dry investigation, you know, to it. You've got, you know, a male lead, a female lead, like they're together, they're caught up in this conspiracy, and it just keeps getting weirder and weirder until at the end it's like blah. Here's what the movie was about. And it's like, holy shit, that's what this movie was about? Fuck.
Yeah.
Although it is interesting, one of the things I find really interesting is that this movie actually, because that final scene is the reason to watch the movie. Like, everything about that final scene is fucking great.
Oh, yeah.
And the way they, you know, that everything climaxes. Once they get darted and they end up taken into
CONSEC.
CONSEC.
Broadcasting live from CONSEC headquarters, it's Junk Food Cinema.
That's right. Once they're in there, all of that stuff is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about it is that they actually make fun of the movie. Like you talk about there's no levity, and there's not, but very dryly you have Michael Ironside, who fucking rules in this movie.
Oh my God. Like beyond the head exploding scene, probably the biggest reason to watch this movie is Michael Ironside.
Who's not in enough of it.
No.
But interestingly, he sits there and he goes and he critiques the plot of the movie by saying, yeah, he took you and pulled you out of the slime, cleaned you up, and then sent you after me like some half-ass spy. Like, and it's like, yeah, that's what this entire movie was fucking about.
Oh,
they
yeah.
find some crazy homeless guy and they turn him into a spy to go track down Revick. And that is a very stupid plot, and you're thinking that while you're watching it, but then the movie critiques it, making it kind of okay. And it actually, what's interesting is that final scene makes everything else make sense, because you're like, if this guy's so powerful, why isn't he not just killed this guy?
Yeah. And I feel like that's actually more than levity, just a vent for Cronenberg's frustration, where he's literally just like, I fucking wrote this spy movie for some reason, and now I'm at the end, and I don't know what to do with it. And then kind of having a character make reference to that feels like the venting of that frustration. But I actually really, really love Michael Ironside in this movie, but I agree with you, he is not in it enough. And we should probably touch a little bit on the actual story of this, because it felt very familiar. I know there's a plethora of movies that have used the idea of, you know, an entity creates a thing to be a weapon that thing gets out of control and they have to recruit something else to stop the thing that they created. But basically, we have this company called Consec, who they are a weapons manufacturer. They are one of those companies that's just kind of into everything. You know, they have their fingers in a lot of pies. So one of the things that they're working on for the military is this scanner project where literally people with telekinetic abilities are being used as weapons. And one of them, Daryl Revick, played by Michael Ironside, goes rogue. And there is no bigger fuck you to the company that created you as a scanner than showing up at one of their demonstrations and being like, oh, they have a scanner up there. I'm going to pretend that I don't know what that is. And then I'm going to go up there and make his head explode just to prove I'm better at this. And then I'm going to escape when they try to capture me. So the board, which is resided over by Dr. Paul Ruth, played by...
Dr. Ruth?
No, not that Dr. Ruth. He's not a tiny waifish woman giving really awkward sex advice. Patrick McGoohan, who is himself a Junk Food Cinema alum, playing the Phantom's dad in The Phantom, because nobody refuses to put Patrick McGoohan in a movie. He plays Dr. Ruth, and I love his performance in this movie because he is clearly to blame for all of this, but he has this no fucks to give attitude about everyone else in the room, especially the guy they bring in, their head of security, to kind of oversee this crisis project that they have going on, a man named Keller, played by Lawrence Dane. And they come to realize that Michael Ironside is recruiting an entire army of scanners to take over the world, and so they have to stop him. And so their solution is that they find a very powerful scanner basically living on the street, whose name is Cameron Vale, and they are training him to infiltrate Revick's whole network of scanners and put a stop to it. And of course, that ends up leading to a lot of people getting killed by other shadowy factions of Consec and the government, and leading up to this revelation that what created scanners. And this is what's interesting, because it's historically, I don't want to say historically accurate, but it's based on something that actually happened, where the scanning was caused by a product that was marketed to Femoral, I believe it was what it was called. It's marketed in, within the movie, marketed to pregnant women as a nausea cure. And what ended up happening was all of these women gave birth to scanners. And Femoral becomes a discontinued drug, but the only thing that can manage the scanners is this drug.
It's essentially the thalidomide story.
Yes.
But what if instead of creating flipper babies, it created psychic powers?
And what I think is fascinating about that is it takes all of the magic out of an otherwise magical concept.
This is what fascinates me about psychic powers. Just this notion that, you know, when it comes to science fiction and fantasy, it's very much, you know, like a peanut butter and chocolate situation where, you know, people, you know,
where I eat too much of both and get diabetes.
Yeah, that's exactly it. No, yeah, but where, yeah, it's like, oh my God, you got your chocolate and my peanut butter. Oh my God, you got your peanut butter and my chocolate. Like, people do not like putting aliens and magic in the same movie. Like, right. It just does not compute. You know, that's one of the things that flipped people out about the last Indiana Jones movie. Was the fact that, wait, he's...
Just that it sucked.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's searching for, you know, ancient artifacts that are magical, and then all of a sudden, interdimensional aliens show up. People felt a strong disconnect at that very point. Like, there's other complaints that could be made, like nuking the fridge, but that point is a real point of contention. You see that in movies. Whenever people experiment with it, people do not like getting their sci-fi and their fantasy mixed together.
Well, and I think especially you have to, if you're going to do that, that has to be in a vacuum. And the problem with the Indiana Jones doing that in the fourth movie is you've spent at least two of those movies confirming that God exists, and then you spend the fourth movie going, never mind, it's aliens.
Yeah, no, that's the problem.
Pick a room.
But the reason I bring this all up is because those rules change when it comes to psychic powers. Like, psychic powers don't get grouped into the superhero movie rules. They even though they are essentially superhero movies, they're not. They're essentially fantasy movies. It's like, someone has magical powers that allows me to what? Read your thoughts, or allows me to move shit with my mind, or allows me to set people on fire. Like, these are things that occur in all these movies. But if we hook somebody up to a machine and say, but science, like here, what they do is you're not reading his mind. You're connecting your nervous system to their nervous system with without traversing that space. And then later on, they explain, well, you could do it with a computer. How the fuck can I do it with a computer? Well, a computer has a nervous system too. Well, by the way, no, it fucking doesn't. It doesn't make any fucking sense. But you don't give a shit, because once you say, but science with psychic powers, people fucking buy it. And of course, at this particular point in history, this is a point in time where we as a culture were obsessed with the idea of psychic powers possibly existing, with ESP, with, you know, they would have, you know, telekinetics and mind readers on The Tonight Show. People were obsessed with Bigfoot. They were obsessed with the Bermuda Triangle. Like, in the 70s and early 80s, we were just obsessed with these great mysteries of the universe that we chalked up to science. Like, there's a scientific explanation to all this. Like, aliens are real. Other dimensions are real. The Aztecs were, you know, were birthed by aliens. Like, all this shit was stuff that was talked about on the fucking news like it was fucking real.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, that stuff all kind of fell out of favor. You know, there are still people who believe that maybe ESP and things like that exist, even though it doesn't seem to make much sense. But if you just tack on the word science, people will buy it, and you can make these movies. And that's the interesting thing. Like, that's why Dreamscape works. You know, I have psychic powers. If you plug me into a machine, I can go into people's dreams. Like, that doesn't fucking make any sense, but we buy it. And we also end up buying it, later on in Inception, where, you know, they never really explain the function of it. They just show us the briefcase with all the chemicals in it. And all of a sudden you assume, well, yes, if we plug wires into each other and take these chemicals, yeah, of course we can go into people's dreams. So this is this very weird subgenre that gets to skirt the line between magic and science fiction. And people love it. And it's such a great subgenre. I super, super wish it was a subgenre we saw more of.
Mm-hmm.
But really, that's become more of, it's fallen into like superhero stuff.
Yeah.
And we see that stuff, but in superhero movies with other powers. Like, we have yet to see a superhero movie that's just mental powers in this era.
Yeah, and it's, you look at something like the X-Men, and it's like, those, they try and add a scientific explanation of that by calling that's just a mutation. It's like,
but
it's happening with a frequency that you need a little bit more than the MacGuffin of just saying a mutation, but they don't, that's not really the point of an X-Men movie.
Yeah.
Whereas something like this goes out of its way, right or wrong, to establish a grounded scientific explanation for what in any other movie would be magic.
And the Marvel Universe, by the way, the comics universe has an explanation for that. They actually ended up writing an explanation for why all these mutations have started showing up. Although Stan Lee has also publicly said, yeah, the reason we created it was because we were tired of coming up with new ways to turn people into superpowers. And we said, mutants, they're just mutants. That's how they got their powers.
I realize there were other letters in the Greek alphabet besides gamma. Yeah, and you have to come up with something other than fucking gamma rays. And maybe they did. Maybe they did explain
toxic waste
it. But how long was the X-Men around before that explanation creeps up? And then even that gets disputed. And you look at the movies, and the movies don't try to explain it any further than this is just a mutation.
And, by the way, for those of you sitting there going, well, what's the explanation? Literally, it's that half a million years ago, these great beings showed up and seated.
Fucking aliens?
Fucking aliens.
God damn it.
Seeded our DNA with the ability to mutate at some point. And this is what they do all across the universe, because once people start, beings start developing powers, they, that's their real test to see if they will evolve as a species. And then those aliens come back and judge what we've done with our powers.
Which gave birth to a new X-Men villain, the Fridge Nuker.
Fucking aliens, man.
Fucking aliens.
Fucking aliens.
I could go on like a 30-minute rant about everything that's wrong with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but I choose to scan my own brain and make the wrinkle that contains that movie just pop, so I never have to think about it again.
So let's talk about this climax.
Let's do that.
Because this climax is fucking great. It actually, all of the, it's got to be one of the last things they shot. Like, it's got to be.
Oh, for sure.
Because in it,
well, I mean, considering
they literally
he's
explain
it
all the plot holes.
Yeah, he's writing it as he's shooting it, so of course this is the last thing they shot. He didn't know, if they had done this out of sequence, he wouldn't have known what to put on the fucking screen.
That
so,
is a possibility.
Yeah, they had to have shot this last, but you get to the big showdown between Vale and Revic, and
Vale, by the way, has all of the charisma of a wet towel. Like, he is... That's the thing about, like, Michael Ironsides is pure chewing the scenery Michael Ironsides in all the ways that you love Michael Ironsides. He's just menacing. He's fantastic. Most of what he does is make contorted expressions on his face
mm-hmm.
to illustrate what psychic thing is going on, and you are mesmerized by him. The guy who plays Vale, on the other hand.
Or, as I've dubbed him, boring as Benedict Cumberbatch.
Oh.
Because he looks like an early 80s Benedict Cumberbatch without any of the appeal of Benedict Cumberbatch. Or the cheekbones of Benedict Cumberbatch. But they end up getting into this battle. Now, this is the thing that is classically Cronenberg about this movie. One of the things. This showdown happens. This head explosion we've already seen, the battle between the two of them, after it's revealed, hey, by the way, we're brothers, and our father is Dr.
Identical brothers.
Yeah, it's like Patty Duke with head explosions, which is a show I would have watched all goddamn day. Are you kidding me? Identical cousins?
That make heads explode?
And one of them makes the other one's head explode, and then that one assimilates the other? Fuck yeah, I would have watched that show.
That's the really super awesome, brilliant thing about this movie that makes it so memorable, is not just the blood, you know, the effects work, which is great for the time. There are certain effects, like towards the end, that don't survive the test of time. That some of them, they look like makeup appliances leaking blood.
That's the thing I was going to say, is like, that's the thing that works the best for me, is the idea of, you know, being psychic throughout a lot of this movie is, you know, just holding your eyes open real wide, and then somebody just does something that you've clearly made them do. And even the big head explosion in the beginning is viscerally upsetting. The final showdown between Revic and Vale, yikes! Like your own
now,
body.
There's some great. There are some that I don't want to disparage
in from the inside. It's just, oh my God.
Dude,
God.
There's a shot where his eyes explode,
mm-hmm.
and that shot is just like, oh, fuck, his eyes.
Yeah.
God damn. And the thing is, it's so brilliantly constructed because we're watching this battle of these two, the two most powerful scanners fucking ripping each other apart.
Yeah.
And Revic wins. Like, you watch him destroy Vale, like, to the point that not only is Vale has he bleeding out from wounds all over his body, his eyes explode, he catches on fucking fire and cooks from the inside out, and you're like, fuck. And while all this is going on, we see Revic's eyes roll into the back of his head, and he's like, and it's the poster, it's, you know, it's photos that you've seen of this movie going around, it's all that in this great moment of Michael Ironside just being like, and then what you find out is really going on is that Vale is working his way into Revic's mind and swapping bodies.
He's incepted him.
And that's the interesting thing about this movie, is this movie never makes the psychic powers clear what people can do. They can just do all sorts of shit.
Yeah.
And not everybody can do the same things. We don't know. They never lay down the rules as to whether they all can. But like, yeah, when we see, you know, when we've got the circle of scanners all joining minds to give us more exposition. Like, literally, they're joining minds to share with each other, see how cool this is, see how powerful we can be when we join our minds together. This is what we're doing. This is our mission. And it's like, well, thank you for explaining that with your psychic powers. And then these guys with guns come in, because the first half of the movie is people with guns running in and shooting people.
Yeah.
And then we see our first real use of like telekinetic powers, to where it picks up, well, we kind of see it in an earlier scene, but picks it up, throws someone against the wall and bursts into flames and starts running around flaming. And that's like, shit, that these are very different powers than we've been seeing. Like, this isn't just telepathy. Like, so we see psychokinesis, we see pyrokinesis, telekinesis, telepathy, you know, there's so many.
But do we need anyone to create fireworks? Nope. Sorry, Jubilee, you're still out. Don't need you.
Do not mock Jubilee.
Stupid powers.
Oh, man. No, there is no kicking of Jubilee on this podcast.
It would be easy. Her fireworks couldn't stop you from kicking her.
Stop it. But yeah, it's so we see Revic start using all of these fucking powers at the end. Like, and this is where you see the makeup appliances, where all of a sudden Vale is just bleeding out from all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's really interestingly constructed, because it's, you're watching the bad guy just kick the shit out of the good guy, because we are, as you mentioned, he's actually trying to incept. He's not trying to destroy Revic's body, because he's going to take it. And I think that's really fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, you would not see that kind of an ending at, you know, in modern cinema, because we kind of need the stakes to go back and forth, and we need to see the good guy get the upper hand a bit before losing the upper hand and before finally winning. And here we're just watching him get destroyed.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I always think about, in terms of the effects and the presentation of the graphic violence in a Cronenberg movie, to me, it's like what would happen if a surgeon was in charge of making a slasher movie. It's like, all of a sudden, it wouldn't be fun and hooting and howling anymore. It'd be like, oh, that's really upsetting. Like, those are, that looks infected. Do we need to put something on that?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you get in a Cronenberg movie. Like, that surgical level of detail of trauma. And it's really upsetting and enthralling at the same time. And that's entirely what this final showdown is. Like, when Vale starts pulling pieces of his own face, like, in chunks off, and you're just like, I can't look at this. And I started thinking again about what my fiance said. I'm like, this is a fucking juicy movie. And so, yeah, that is really just, oh, it's up there. But so yeah, it's like watching a surgeon watch a horror movie is entirely what's going on. But so it ends with the female scanner, who we've unfortunately not even mentioned yet, played by Jennifer O'Neill, who comes to what she thinks is Revic, or what she thinks is Vale, with a coat on in the corner. Turns out to be Revic speaking in Vale's voice and says, "It's me. It's Vale. We've won."
And his eyes are Vale's colors.
Yes. Which, by the way, is a really interesting connection to the movie The Fury, because it has almost the exact same ending as The Fury. The Fury is a very different movie tonally, but ends with someone exploding from the inside and someone's consciousness basically being transferred from one person to another, both with psychic abilities. So it's just really fascinating. But another thing to keep in mind when you're watching this, and it's very, I don't want to say it's not entertaining, because there are entertaining elements. There are shootouts, there are car chases. You got Michael Ironside. But it is as dry as eating a rice cake in Santa Fe in August. Like, it really does slog along, and you are trying to figure out whether you care about this mystery or whether you just want to see someone's head explode. And I do think it's funny that at one point in the movie, as Cargill mentioned, they start throwing in this computer nonsense to the point that they basically do a phone freak. But it's not phone freaking, it's phone scanning.
I was going to mention this because let's go back a few months to our hackers episode. And so here we have mind hacking that includes the best shots of the movie, these beautiful flyovers of circuit boards. That is very much similar to what they did with the flyovers of the digital circuit boards and hackers. I really think this laid the groundwork for the thought process by the director hackers of like, oh, I want to do this, but what if we do it, you know, very 1990s, where they're digital effects. We're not flying over circuit boards. We're flying over circuit cities.
now circuit out of business. Now out of business. This episode brought to you by Circuit City. If you can find one, Circuit City.
But yeah, so
unplug Circuit City.
So yeah, it's that the phone freaking is a really interesting sequence.
I love the shot of the phone melting at the end of that, though.
That it, yeah, that is pure Cronenberg. Like the fact that they don't want to shut down the computer; they want to blow up the computer.
Yeah,
and so they've actually built a box to destroy all the circuits of the computer. They press the button.
They have a doomsday button.
They've got a doomsday button.
This is a corporation with an IT department that has to be trained on how to use the doomsday button. Yes. Are you kidding me right now?
You know, I would argue that we talked about there's no levity here, but I feel like there is one joke in the movie. Like, there is one joke, and that joke is in that scene where the guy who looks oddly like Henry Mazza from the Alamo Drafthouse, like an older, like, Italian Henry Mazza, is sitting in a chair. And you know, the security guy is waving the gun around. He's like, man, there's no need for that. It's going to turn off. It's all going to happen just quiet. And then and gets blown through the glass, and killed.
And he's like, oh, I forgot this movie doesn't understand how technology works. No.
So they blow up the computers but what it is it's psychic backlash, which is what's interesting. And we see like the phone line catch on fire while a guy is gassing up his car. It blows up a gas station. The phone is melting. Like, it's just fuck yeah. Let's just go for it.
Yeah.
And it's pure, crazy, wonderful Cronenberg. So the few set pieces this movie has are kind of fucking cool.
They really are. And it's just interesting that you get to the end of this movie and it starts just laying things out on a table like a Bond villain. And you don't even realize that you needed that, because really, for a while, this thing feels like the fucking Matrix, where it's just like, okay, there are people with these abilities, and then there's a shadowy government agency trying to get rid of all of them, and they're basically having to form an underground. And so, I mean, there's a lot of like Matrix-like elements to it, and you can enjoy it on that level. You got car chases, and you got shootouts, and you got really weirdo bonkers characters. But then it starts getting really, you know, corporate. It starts getting really insidery, where it's like, we have to blow the lid off this program, and the fact that it's been manipulated by, you know, greedy corporations, like, to the point that it's like, I think Consect set up their headquarters right across the street from Weyland-Yutani. Like, all the evilest corporations in the world probably are in the same corporate cul-de-sac, and Consec would definitely...
They share a building with the Umbrella Corporation?
Yes, absolutely. They absolutely share a building with the Umbrella Corporation. But yeah, there's just like the veins bursting open and like just chunks of viscera
gnarly.
Being, oh my, gnarly is the exact right word for it. And it's interesting to me that part of what Cronenberg is drawing from as far as source material is William S. Burroughs, because there's a whole section of Naked Lunch, which Cronenberg would later adapt into a movie, that talks about senders. And senders were these characters with psychic abilities. And now, granted, in that book...
And the thing is that I don't believe is actually from Naked Lunch. I think that's from Inner Zone.
It's one of the things that happens...
Yeah, no, I'm not...
In Naked Lunch.
Yeah, no. The interesting thing about Naked Lunch, the movie, and it's a movie I would love to cover sometime in the future, so take a drink.
Take a drink.
Is he actually... Cronenberg combined four different Burroughs books into Naked Lunch. So it's a combination of Naked Lunch, Inner Zone, Exterminator, and one of the lesser known ones that I'm blanking on the moment. He's borrowing from Burroughs, who heavily influenced him.
And it's but the thing about that book is that so much of what happens in that is basically the feverish, drug-induced imagination of a guy who, you know, was hooked on pesticides and accidentally killed his wife because he was high. So it's like the most unreliable narrator of unreliable narrators. And what Cronenberg did was take that concept from one of his favorite writers and try to make the most white collar, logistically sound, grounded version of that story. And I think that's why there are elements that don't quite work. But overall, I think what Scanners accomplishes, not only in terms of visual effects, but in terms of creating a style that would later cement Cronenberg as one of the best genre filmmakers of all time, makes this a massively important movie that I do think has elements that'll keep you engaged even after, you know, the dog food and liver-filled balloon is shot with a 12 gauge in slow motion and looks perfectly like a man's head exploding.
Yeah, it's this is why I wanted to talk about this movie, because people asked, you know, are we going to talk about The Fury? Are we going to talk about The Dead Zone? And I wanted to talk about Scanners because I find Scanners so fascinating. Nobody asked if we were going to talk about Watchers, oddly enough.
I don't think that's that odd. I think that's par for the course here.
Come on, it's a psychic golden retriever. That's the most adorable psychic ever.
I'm proud of our listeners, in fact, for not suggesting Watchers.
But the thing is that I think The Fury and The Dead Zone are both significantly better movies than Scanners. I think they accomplish certain things, that they're much better constructed. They're better stories. The Fury is like 3 years older, you know, mm-hmm. and this is borrowing from that. So in fact, one would argue that it's probably ripping off some of that, like, for its ending. But why is this the one that is the most influential? Why is it everyone goes back to Scanners? Like, why is this the touchstone?
Yeah.
Is it the gore? Is it just Cronenberg's rep? Or is it just that it came at just the right time and knew how to explain it in such a way that it created that language that everybody else then used in all of these psychic films that would come out over the next few years?
Yeah.
Because this is all very much like the two films we talked about previously, you know, Dreamscape and Argento's Phenomena, aka Creepers, would not exist without Scanners.
No,
and which would not exist without The Fury, which would not exist without Carrie.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about that. This is the movie that is like third in line in that sequence, and yet is the one that is the most important, that inspired so much to come after it. Just to touch on it, in The Naked Lunch, Senders are one of the three political factions that get referred to as notorious liquefactionists. This book is fucking bonkers. Like, it is.
Yeah, if you guys ever want to read some, like, if you guys enjoy reading every once in a while, Burroughs is one of my favorites. I grew up reading like Burroughs' entire pile of books. He's amazing. He's fucked up. He is just bonkers. In fact, there's a great you can find it online. There's a great album he put out, I want to say in 93 or 94, in which he read and DJs mixed music to go with his reading. So you can literally sit and listen to this weird auric soundscape for an hour while Burroughs reads some of his stories, including one of my favorite, the most Cronenberg of Cronenberg, the one that you read this story and you're like, of course, this is the well that Cronenberg went to, was a story called Spare Ass Annie, which is about a girl who has an asshole on the center of her forehead.
It's weird to think that censors didn't like William S. Burroughs.
Yeah, censors were not big Burroughs fans, oddly enough. Mm. You know, that and the fact that, you know, he got drunk and high all the time and shot his wife playing William Tell. So these are real.
Which makes the character in Naked Lunch such an autobiographical character, the mouthpiece for Burroughs himself. And yeah, go read Naked Lunch. Just be aware that it is crazier than Gary Busey on bath salts. I'm going to eat your face.
Oh, dude, try. You know what? Naked Lunch is everyone's go-to. My favorite, though, is Exterminator. Like, Exterminator's a series of short stories.
From the year 3000?
Oh, no. Okay. I do love Exterminator's the year 3000. Possible future episode.
Take a drink.
Dead Zone, also another future episode.
Oh, so take another drink.
Take all the drinks.
You're going to take a drink now. It's going to be good. Refreshing, even. Good.
So, Exterminator, it all kind of weaves together eventually, like certain elements start showing up in other stories, and you start seeing other elements that come from other books like Dr. Benway and things like that. So it's if you are a Cronenberg fan, Burroughs is definitely a place to go.
Now I'm just thinking about my favorite line, my favorite delivery in all of The Dead Zone, which is just Christopher Walken going,
"The ice is gonna break."
Oh, I can't even do it because it's that weird other man, the snarly Christopher Walken that nobody can do an impression of because it's just fucking otherworldly. He says it in the snarly Christopher Walken voice. It's like, the ice is going to break. It's so good. But that being said, now that we've talked about Scanners, what is your favorite Cronenberg movie?
My favorite Cronenberg movie still is probably The Fly.
It is mine too. And this viewing actually cemented that because I always kind of went back and forth between that and Scanners. And watching this again, I was like, you know, it is definitely The Fly. And don't get confused.
I do owe Eastern Promises a rewatch because I really love Eastern Promises.
Eastern Promises is great. History of Violence, I think, is one of the...
History of Violence is one of his... arguably one of his best films.
Yeah.
But it's not one of my favorites.
It's one of my favorites. And it's the answer I give whenever someone says to me that... whenever a book gets adapted into a movie, it's always worse. I'm like, actually,
yeah, no.
History of Violence is a way better movie than it is a graphic novel on so many levels. And don't get confused when you start watching Scanners, if you're watching it for the first time and you're a big fan of The Fly, because you might think you put in the wrong disc, because both movies start with text over a black screen and classical music. Yeah. It's really funny. I thought for a minute, I was like, shit, did I put in the wrong disc? And I need to get that Criterion because I have the shitty... single disc DVD that came out, and it is so bad that it looks like it's dubbed.
Oh,
like the audio doesn't line up.
The Criterion is the version that's online.
See, I had
a
DVD.
You can actually watch the Criterion. That's what you stream from Amazon. Amazon streams the Criterion.
Well, definitely do that. Don't watch if you have the shitty single disc that came out several years ago. It's awful. Do not. I highly recommend not watching that.
You pray it will end, and it will.
Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing.
Junk food pairing. I have one this week.
Oh, shit. Well, then
you have one?
I did, but I will.
I want to hear yours. And then I actually came up with one while watching the movie.
I always leave
this to you.
Yeah.
And
this is so that you can dogpile on my choice the minute it leaves my mouth. Yeah. I get your
schtick.
Fucking strategy, Cargill.
It's our shtick.
It is shtick. No, actually, and I will admit freely after getting up on my soapbox about that I did not have one for this week until about 2 minutes ago. And then I thought of one based on all of the gore and all of the and the juiciness, that, as my fiance put it. So I'm going to go with Gushers.
Oh, Gushers. Okay.
Gushers fruit snacks. Take a bite of one and imagine that that's a man's head exploding in slow motion. Thank you very much, Dick Smith.
Okay, me, I'm going to recommend bratwurst.
You have my attention.
What you need to do is you need to get the bratwurst, you know, prepare your bratwurst the way you're going to prepare it, you know, whether you're going to grill it, whether you're going to boil it. I recommend boiling it for this. Then you're going to put it in the microwave.
Oh, here we go.
For a minute and a half. And you'll know it's ready when it pops.
If you happen to be listening to this and you still live with your parents, the opinions of Cargill do not necessarily represent those of Junk Food Cinema and should not be taken as instructional.
I kind of
get a lot of angry letters from
scraping
parents.
Scraping sausage out of a microwave and eating the detritus of a blown brat. Is about as Scanners as you're going
to
get.
Nothing like scraped sausage detritus, just like Mom used to make you eat when you were bad. Way to go, Cargill. That's you know what?
It helps if at the end you just look up and go, it's me. We won.
You're like a mean-spirited or a more mean-spirited Mr. Wizard. Like you didn't just recommend a snack.
You don't get more mean spirit. Mr. Wizard was a dick.
That guy was a dick. Don't let anybody tell you different.
The internet has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt he was no Bill Nye the Science Guy.
No, because he was always like, you don't know how ice works, you fucking moron? Come on. I'll show you. Yeah, and you know he put those kids in danger like 24/7.
Well, that was the beauty of the dinosaurs parody of that, where it was, it looks like we need another Timmy.
Now, make sure that you come up real slowly from that deep dive reference. I don't want anybody getting the bends. But yes, on the show Dinosaurs, there was a segment, and I remember this very fondly.
Mr. Lizard's World.
Mr. Lizard's World. We're going to need another Timmy.
Now, I'm going to stand behind this blast shield.
Yeah, I'm going to stand behind this lead blast shield.
For those of you that aren't familiar with dinosaurs, like there's older guys out there who are just like, oh, fuck yeah. It had the fucking MASH of endings. Like, it is a show.
Oh, my God. MASH looked like fucking Happy Days next to the ending of Dinosaurs.
No. Have you ever seen the last episode of MASH?
No.
The last episode of MASH is one of the greatest episodes of television ever, where I'm pretty sure it's Hawkeye is in a mental institution, and he's dealing with this shit that happened to him back in Korea. And the thing is he was on a bus. There were... there were people nearby that were looking for them, and they've got this chicken, and this chicken won't stop clucking, and so this woman is holding this chicken to try to keep the chicken from clucking, and is silencing the chicken, and ends up accidentally smothering the chicken, and he keeps telling the story over and over again until by the end of the final episode, he realizes he's, in his mind, he's made it a chicken, and it's a baby. And this is the most fucked up thing that happened to him in Korea. And this is the thing that broke him. And it's that, this is that ending with puppet fucking dinosaur suits. Like, it is all of a sudden the ice age is coming. The world is ending. And the dinosaurs are all huddling together in their hut for warmth as it's snowing outside. And you realize the entire cast is about to die.
You know, you adjusted the gravity on our junk food spaceship and brought everything down. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, the final episode of MASH is fucking genius. Like, whether you've watched MASH or not, you can go track down that final episode. It is fucking great.
Suicide is painless. Hearing the description of that final episode of MASH, not so much. Holy crap.
But so great junk food cinema, guys.
Hey,
today was a real upper.
Scanning for maudlin. Yep, found it. And if you would like to hear more things that are slightly more upbeat than that, you can always follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show and don't want to see it have as dour an ending as Dinosaurs or MASH, go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Kick some shekels into the hat. For as little as $4 a month, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. Mailbags, alamodes. We do it all.
Sometimes
top fives. We have a number of different things that we do just for, and we really do sincerely appreciate our patrons. We talk to you guys on social media all the time. Your questions are fucking great, and we love conversing with you, so please consider doing that. So Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MASSAWYRM, or on Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. That is where I live on the interwebs. And until next time, remember, and I'm going to say this to all the scanners among you. Right?